Welcome to Mornings with Mike, Public Safety Today. Grab a coffee and sign up to receive your call-in information. Be a part of the show. For more information at any time, please visit www.tapsd.org. Now, let's get started with your host, Mike Pozzesny.
Hello, everybody. This is Mike Pozzesny from American Public Safety Training Institute with a web address of www.tapsti.org. This two-hour session includes the work of Albert Roberts in this textbook entitled Correctional Counseling and Treatment, Evidence-Based Perspective. This is a Prentice Hall text published in 2008 by Pearson. I'm your host during this seminar, and the seminar is dedicated to my students, to the men and women of public safety, and to the juvenile justice counselors and probation officers, administrators, and all the rest of those folks who try to inform us how to be better peacekeepers. Now, when we talk about correctional counseling, specifically as regards the sex offenders out there, some people may say that this kind of puts us on edge. It taxes us. I've got a little cut here of something that might help you to approach what is going to be a very intense kind of discussion about sex offenders. We're going to be going over a lot of the instruments that are used to be able to better understand these folks and assess them so that they can get the help that they need. And so I have a short clip that's going to help you to know what number you should call in order to be able to maximize the benefit to you as an individual who may get involved with juvenile offenders who are sex offenders. Hang on just a moment, please.
Hello and welcome to the Mental Health Hotline. If you are obsessive compulsive, press 1 repeatedly. If you are codependent, ask someone to press 2 for you. If you have multiple personalities, press 3, 4, 5, and 6. If you are paranoid, we know what you are and what you want. Stay on the line and we'll trace your call. If you're delusional, press 7 and your call will be transferred to the mothership. If you are schizophrenic, listen carefully and a small voice will tell you which number to press. If you are depressive, it doesn't matter which number you press, no one will answer you. If you are dyslexic, press 69696969. If you have a nervous disorder, please fidget with the hash key until the beep. After the beep, please wait for the beep. If you have a short-term memory loss, please try your call again later. And if you have low self-esteem, hang up. All our operators are too busy to talk to you.
Okay, now that's a pretty intense kind of solution to your problem, but just in the event you were lost and didn't know quite what to do with yourself, I thought I'd go ahead and help you have at least some direction depending on how you might be yourself. So I thought that was pretty decent. There's been a rapid growth and expansion of correctional institutions in America in the 1980s and 1990s. Between 82 and 2003, correctional expenditures for all levels of government, federal, state, and local, increased a whopping 573%. In 1982, total correction expenditures were about $9 billion. By 2003, these had increased to about $61 billion, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics in 2006. This rapid growth in correctional expenditures was accompanied with a rapid growth, obviously, in the incarcerated population. In 2004, we had about 7 million people in America who were in prison or jail or on probation. Between 1995 and 2005, the incarcerated population in America grew at an annual rate of about 3.5%. In 2001, about $38 billion was spent by state authorities for corrections, and out of that, about $28 billion was spent for adult correctional facilities, and in 2001, about 60% of the justice expenditures of the states of this country were for corrections alone. So we have to consider, when we're talking about sex offenders, you say, well, Mike, how does this roll into sex offenders? We have to consider this growth and expansion in corrections and the huge burdens that this has brought on the correctional industry in this country in the context of the emerging policy model of prison reentry. Correctional institutions are being increasingly asked to build those bridges between themselves and the communities. And we all know that the community around a state prison very often consists of people who are related to the inmates within. And the community which is immediately around a state prison can be quite dysfunctional. Now, I've seen some prisons that had very high cost of living homes and such around them. And that's typically because the prison was tucked away and those people didn't even know that it was there, which is amazing to me that they wouldn't drive around and look, but that's the way some people are. So there's a new managerial paradigm that's growing up in American corrections. And what we're starting to do is to emphasize that offender management should be seen in terms of a more holistic perspective, a more comprehensive perspective that combines risk assessment and treatment with new goals and planning for reentry and offender management within the communities. And a lot of that expansion was planned and guided nationally by something known as the Center for Sex Offender Management, a federal program that was established in 97 by the Office of Justice Programs, part of the umbrella organization for the U.S. Department of Justice, in collaboration with the National Institute of Justice, National Institute of Corrections, State Justice Institute, and the American Probation and Parole Association. And the core of the CSAW model, and for the students out there who are taking my corrections counseling class, it's very important for you to understand this. The core of the CSAW model is that sex offender management must begin with effective assessment and treatment of sex offenders inside the prison. Reentry and recidivism depend on whether the risk of reoffending was effectively assessed and suitable treatment plans were then made and then offered, implemented, completed, that kind of thing. The post-incarceration success of sex offender registration, then notification, tracking, and management is now seen as intimately connected with effective sex offender assessment and treatment during incarceration in prison. It is because of this emerging comprehensive approach in dealing with sex offenders both within the institution and then bridging them back into the community and then supervising them within the community that correctional institutions are re-examining the existing methods of sex offender assessment and treatment. And so these are the things that we're going to be focusing on here. Within the institution, bridging them over to reentry, and then what do we do with them within the local communities? Now, sexual offenders and sex offenders under correctional supervision have a lot to do with the reporting of crimes within our local communities, right? The major governmental sources and surveys on sex offense data that we use include the Uniform Crime Reports, which we know has its share of misgivings, the National Crime Victimization Survey, which actually does a lot more for us, the National Incident-Based Reporting System, NIBRS, we've talked about that in other segments, and the National Corrections Reporting Program. The National Sexual Violence Resource Center collects a lot of crime data on sex offenders as an advocacy organization. We also have the National Violence Against Women Survey, the National College of Women's Victimization Survey, and the NCVS and the NIBRS, however, collect and codify most of the government-based data, which is going to be out there on sex offenses, and those are the two that we rely on probably more than the rest. The NCVS collects sexual data in terms of two broad categories. One is rape and one is sexual assault. NIBRS, the National Incidents-Based Reporting System, divides sex crimes data into six major categories. You have forcible rape, statutory rape, forcible sodomy, forcible fondling, including indecent liberties and child molestation, incest, and sexual assault. In addition to these national statistical surveys, there are also sex crimes categories that are defined and described by different state statutes. And so what's happening today is that law is increasingly defining a wide range of sexual acts and behavior and expressions as crimes, which is interesting because the more liberal our society becomes, the more we find to criminalize the things that people are doing within it. And then all of us are taxed with the overhead expenses of having to deal with those people we have now labeled as being social deviants. According to the NCVS, about 50% of all violent crimes are not reported to law enforcement. And of all violent crimes, rape and sexual assaults are less likely to be reported than anything else. From 92 through 2000, on average, about 31% of rapes and sexual assaults were actually reported to law enforcement. Reporting of sexual offenses has increased by about 6% a year in between 92 and 2000, but on average, about 70% of cases still remain unreported. The National Crime Victimization Survey established that in 2004, U.S. residents age 12 and over, isn't it a shame that we have to include ages as young as 12, experienced about 5.2 million violent crimes, including rape and sexual assault. The average annual number of rape and sexual assault victims in 2003 and 4 was about 204,000. Rapes, 65,000. Attempted rapes, 43. Sexual assaults, about 95. So the annual victimization rate for rape and sexual assault in this country is about 1 per 1,000 households. So who gets involved in this? Well, and how does this tie in with what we're doing with juveniles? The majority of victims of sexual offenses, victims, are juveniles. In his analysis of the NIBRS NIBRS data on reported sexual offenses in 12 states from 91 through 96, Snyder, who published his study in 2000, found that about 67% of all victims of sexual assault were juveniles under the age of 18, 34% of all victims of sexual assaults were juveniles under the age of 12. One of every seven victims was under the age of six. So when we look at all the victims of sexual assault, roughly a third of them are under the age of 12. Another report that was funded by the National Institute of Justice and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, analyzed the National Violence Against Women survey data that was collected in 95 and 6 and had similar findings. So the Centers for Disease Control and the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control analyzed the data provided by the National Violence Against Women survey in 2004. And what they did was they estimated about 5.3 million women across this country become the victims of intimate partner violence every year at a cost of roughly $5.8 billion a year, about $4.1 billion of that being used for medical and mental health care services. About 7.8 million women have been raped by an intimate partner at some point in their lives, and an estimated 200,000 women are raped by an intimate partner each year. It's also estimated intimate partners kill about 30% of the female murder victims and 4% of male murder victims every year. So what I'm trying to do is here, I'm trying to utilize your textbook to put some of these things in perspective. We're talking about a huge problem when it comes to sex offenders. And the assaults that they commit take place in a number of different places. This is not all in their homes. It's in homes, it's in schools, colleges, work. It's in daycare centers, it's in nursing homes, it's within our prisons. About 70% of sexual assaults reported to law enforcement take place in the homes of the victims of the offenders because they know each other. Snyder did an analysis that was published in 2000 of NIBRS data and revealed that roughly 83% of your rape victims, 81% of your forcible sodomies, 82% of your forcible fondlings were victims are ages from 6 to 11 occurred within a residence. So 80% of the cases, basically, if the victim is between 6 to 11, it's going to be considered, it's going to happen within the residence. When the juvenile ages shifted to 12 to 17, 69% of those cases had the forcible rapes, 73% forcible sodomy, 69% forcible fondling occurring within a residence. Juvenile sexual offending, particularly the victimization of female juveniles between 6 and 17, is more likely to occur within a residence. So you say, well, Mike, our prisons are full of sex offenders. You know, that's the problem with our prison population. Well, not really. The nation's federal prisons house less than 2% of the convicted sex offenders out there. In 2004, the total number of inmates in federal prisons was about 169,000. And out of those inmates, only 1% of inmates were sentenced for sex offenses, compared to 53% of inmates sentenced for drug offenses. The problem with this is, like I mentioned earlier, the trend is growing. And as a result of that, the percentage of inmates who are being sentenced for sex offenses is growing as we begin to redefine what the sex offenses actually are. When we look at state prisons, the numbers shift a little bit. Rape and sexual assault comprise about 11% of all inmates sentenced for violent crimes in state prisons. There were about 625,000 inmates in state prisons who were sentenced for violent crimes in 2004. Out of those 625, roughly 142,000 were sentenced for rape and sexual assault charges. Now, if we take a look at those 142,000, 140,500 of those were males. Only 1,500 were females. All right, does that tell you something, guys? 73,000 of them were whites, 36,000 were blacks, and 19,000 were Hispanics. Now, I'm just kind of rounding things off here to make it easier. The number of inmates sentenced for sex offenses varies a lot from state to state. In 2002, Montana had the highest percentage of inmates incarcerated for sexual offenses, a full third, followed by Vermont. So we're looking at the cold states here. New Hampshire, Massachusetts. In the same year, New Jersey had the District of Columbia had the lowest percentage, only 7% of inmates incarcerated for sexual offenses. Now, you and I both know how the law works and how people get charged. Does that mean that New Jersey has less sexual offenders per capita than Montana? No. What it means is that either the criminal justice system is more focused on it in Montana, maybe they do a better job of catching them in Montana. You know, it doesn't mean that the people in Montana have a greater propensity for sex offenses. It can be a variety of things. It can be a fact that you have people who are being charged with sex offenses in states like New Jersey and D.C., or the District of Columbia, not a state. But the courts are allowing those to be pled down or modified in some way. So we have to be real careful when we look at all these figures, because we're looking at numbers of people who are being sentenced for rape and sexual assault charges, and how many of those were actually reduced to some lower charge like battery or something like that. Some courts much more liberal than others, and that's going to skew the results. So since the definition of sexual offense is broadening, more sex offenses today are reported to law enforcement, more sex offenses are prosecuted in courts, more sex offenders are being sentenced to prison for longer terms. Felony sex offenses are more likely than other violent and nonviolent felony cases to result in convictions, because it shocks the conscience a little bit more. Hello, everybody. This is Mike Pozesny from American Public Safety Training Institute with a web address of www.tapsti.org. This two-hour session includes the work of Albert Roberts in this textbook entitled Correctional Counseling and Treatment, Evidence-Based Perspective. This is a Prentice Hall text published in 2008 by Pearson. I'm your host during this seminar, and the seminar is dedicated to my students, to the men and women of public safety, and to the juvenile justice counselors and probation officers, administrators, and all the rest of those folks who try to inform us how to be better peacekeepers. So let's take a look a little bit at the development of policy as regards sexual offenses. We've seen the numbers. We know that there's a great disparity between any kind of equalization in these numbers. We understand that the numbers can be due to everything from frontline law enforcement supervision to courts to statutes that do or don't apply based on a state basis. I mean, we understand that each of the 50 states have their own definitions and their own statutes and ways of looking at the sexual offender category of crime as they do any other category of crime. But what's the history? What's kind of happened with sexual offenses and sex offenders over time? And the renewed interest in recent years for more effective sex offender assessment and treatment methods came not just in response to growing sex crimes, but in response to the growth of the state statutes and the policy developments that came out of it. And if we take a look at some of the history of these things, we see that a lot of them developed, and I'm not going to say that they paralleled domestic violence statutes and policies, but there's some similarities in the accelerated progress of laws and procedures for dealing with offenders in the sexual assault categories as there have been in the domestic violence realm. So all these different Sex Crimes Against Children Prevention Act of 95 and the Children Online Protection Act of 98 and Federal Campus Sex Crimes Act of 2000, the Prison Rape Elimination Act of 2003, which we're still trying to get fully integrated in the correctional system 10 years later, all of this legislation created new laws for mandatory sex offender registration, community notification, a national sex offender database at the FBI, the National Sex Offender Registry, NSOR. The legislations also created new federal laws for mandatory exchange of sex offender information between federal and state law enforcement agencies, mandatory interstate sharing of sex offender information, mandatory notification of campus sex offenders, expert determination of sex offender classification, the designation of an entirely separate group of sexual offenders as sexual predators, and increased sentencing for repeat and violent sex offenders. All of that has happened essentially in the last 15 to 20 years. So all 50 states generally comply with these and recently enacted federal sex offender laws and guidelines that are in place in different ways. In response to federal guidelines, the states have enacted their own laws. You know, they see these federal laws that come in place and they say, okay, well, we have a gap over here we need to fill. So in 2005 alone, more than 100 new sex offender laws were enacted by state legislatures. There were over 500,000 registered sex offenders 10 years ago in 2005. And the Department of Justice formally announced the activation of a national sex offender registry site in 2005, a requirement mandated by the Pam-Lichner Act. The FBI's Crimes Against Children Unit is responsible for developing and coordinating the NSOR system. And that website gives real-time access to public sex offender information from about 41 states. So these legal and policy developments and such for the creation of a new national initiative and a model for sex offender management brought new mandates both to federal and state correctional authorities for developing more effective methods of assessment and treatment and management of sex offenders. And that's where we're going with this conversation. A lot of correctional departments, a lot of state criminal justice agencies have created boards and commissions for improved scientific advice on correctional assessment and treatment, particularly for sex offenders. Some of these initiatives may include things like the Governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy in Minnesota, the Texas Council of Sex Offenders, which was created within the Texas Department of Health Services, the Sex Offender Management Board in Colorado, the Correctional Institutions Inspection Committee in Ohio, the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, the Virginia Criminal Sentencing Institute, and the list goes on and on and on. So what are some of the challenges in determining sex offender recidivism? We have a person who has been apprehended and has been adjudicated and found guilty and is sentenced to prison. And now they're in prison and we have to figure out what to do with them because they're not going to be in there forever. They're going to be going back to the local community. And given the risk that they pose to the community, there have to be some effective tools for assessing the probability of recidivism so that we are able to design a program that they and we can live with and that the residents of that community can live with and not feel as though they are in harm's way. So we have a reliable means of distinguishing between high and low risk individuals and understanding the circumstances under which they are likely to reoffend as crucial components about allocating program and human resources so that we can manage all of those things in the best possible way. One of the major challenges for effective sex offender assessment is to contain the high rate of recidivism that we have among sex offenders. Key question basic to that being, well, what's the likelihood that this specific offender will commit sexual offenses again? What are the indications in the past behavior of this offender right here and in the nature of his or her specific offenses, their lifestyle, their socioeconomic status, the childhood socialization that they may have had that can help predict whether he or she is more likely to commit sex offenses again? The risk of sexual recidivism varies according to the type of offender that you have. Rapists tend to be more criminally versatile than child molesters. Rapists are more likely to reoffend non-sexually than sexually. Among child molesters, the risk of sexual recidivism is higher for homosexual and extrafamilial sex offenders than it is for heterosexual and incest offenders. And this is the fascinating aspect of what it is that we're doing in 21st century corrections, is in studying and measuring and being able to empirically analyze what the populations are that we're dealing with so that we can design the most efficient systems possible to be able to deal with these. Recidivist sexual offenders exhibit certain characteristics, but specific predictors of sexual recidivism may include things like sexual deviancy, a history of sex offending, especially during early offset of offending and engaging in a range of sexual crimes, diversity in offending, including violent and general crimes, possible psychological maladjustment, including substance abuse issues, or antisocial issues and personality disorders, childhood sexual victimization, the presence of violent sexual fantasies, long-standing social isolation, sadomasochistic or pedophilic pornography, and just plain old failure to complete treatment. So the Bureau of Justice Statistics conducted a major study on sex offender recidivism back in 2003 on the basis of a three-year follow-up. And they studied 9,692 male sex offenders. 4,295 of those were child molesters. 3,000 of them were rapists. And they were released from prison in 15 different states in 1994. According to that study, so we're looking at, 10 years later, right? According to the study, which is one of the largest follow-up studies that was ever done, the released sex offenders compared to released non-sex offenders were four times more likely to commit sexual offenses. Within 3 years, 5.3% of male sex offenders who committed rape or sexual assault were arrested for committing other sexual offenses. The study found that the rate of recidivism is higher among those who had several prior arrest records. Those who had 7 to 10 prior arrests had the highest rate of recidivism, about 8%, compared to those who had one prior arrest, which was down as low as 3%. Out of the 9,692 released sex offenders, 67% were white, about 32% were black, about 1% were other races. And the 4,295 child molesters and 443 statutory rapists were predominantly non-Hispanic white males. Nearly three-fourths of the child molesters, about 73%, were aged 30 or older. And statutory rapists are more likely to reoffend with any type of crime than child molesters. Within 3 years, 50% of the statutory rapists were rearrested, and 33% of them were reconvicted for any type of crime at all, compared to 40% of arrests and 20% conviction of child molesters. In 2003, the Washington State Institute for Public Policy conducted a six-year follow-up study of 89 sex offenders who were released from prison between 90 and 96 with recommendations for civil commitment by the Washington DOC. Their study found a high percentage, 57%, of the subjects were convicted of new felony offenses, with 40% reoffending with against person offenses, including sex offenses. About a third of the group reoffended with a felony sex offense, and 16% failed to register as a sex offender. So what did they conclude? They concluded that violent sexual offenders have a high risk of a subsequent conviction for a felony offense, particularly a new against person, including sex offense. So it's critical that we understand the phenomenon of sex offender recidivism, and it's critical that we understand that that is at the core of concern for effective methods of risk assessment and the responsibilities that rest on our shoulders in being able to do a good job. There's a huge gap in our understanding still of the complexity of this phenomenon. The issues of psychopathology, endocrinology, brain development, social and behavioral context are all intertwined with sexual deviance and sexual violence in this huge, complex kind of sort of interactions. And it's this multifaceted dimensions of the challenge of recidivism that there is now growing a new generation of sex offender risk assessment methods that are more scientific, more empirically based, more multidimensional in perspectives than anything that we've ever had before. And that's kind of exciting. So we're going to take a look at some of those things. So sex offender risk assessment in the correctional setting begins with an evaluation of offender classification, right? And we know that offender classification generally begins as soon as that offender is admitted to the state system. All categories of offenders are classified for custody decisions, risk assessment, treatment, service delivery, but it is a much more rigorous and statutorily mandated process in the case of sex offenders. Many states in recent years have enacted specific statutes for the sex offender classification within their state. And presently, most of this direction about sex offender classification is guided by two federal laws, the Jacob Wetterling Crimes Against Children and Sexually Violent Offenders Registration Improvement Act of 1997. Say that one quick 10 times, and the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act of 2006. The Jacob Wetterling Act created the classification of sexual predators so that we would have that. That's almost 10 years old now. Actually, it's older than 10 years old. Sexual predators are defined as violent and high-risk repeat sex offenders who have the characteristics of psychopathic personalities. However, this act also requires that the determination of whether a person is a sex offender or not has to be made by a court. And that's the tricky part. The court has to receive the advice of a board, and the board has to be composed of mental health and behavioral science experts, representatives from law enforcement agencies, and victims' rights advocates. And then we have the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. This extended the Wetterling classification provisions, and this is where we got the three-tier classification mandatory for sex offender sentencing, risk assessment, and treatment services. This act, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, placed the repeat and violent sex offenders, defined as predators by Jacob Wetterling, in Tier 3. Tier 2 offenders are those who are convicted of federal offenses involving a minor, such as coercion, enticement, transportation, abuse of sexual conduct, use of a minor in sexual conduct, production and distribution of child pornography. Those are Tier 2 offenses. And then those who are convicted for aggravated sexual abuse or kidnapping of a minor are all placed in Tier 1. Most states had already adopted some version of the three-tier system of classification for sex offenders before the whole Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act actually came along. Many states, once the Jacob Wetterling Act came out, enacted specific legislations to define what repeat and violent sex offenders actually meant and call them sexual predators. There was kind of a standard of opinion then. Okay, this is a good stopping point. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Don't go away. Yeah. Hello, everybody. This is Mike Pozesny from American Public Safety Training Institute with a web address of www.tapsti.org. This two-hour session includes the work of Albert Roberts in this textbook entitled Correctional Counseling and Treatment, Evidence-Based Perspective. This is a Prentice Hall text published in 2008 by Pearson. I'm your host during this seminar, and the seminar is dedicated to my students, to the men and women of public safety, and to the juvenile justice counselors and probation officers, administrators, and all the rest of those folks who try to inform us how to be better peacekeepers. One of the most significant policy developments came about through the enactment of the Jessica Lunsford Act, sometimes called Jessica's Law, in Florida in 2005. Under the Jessica Lunsford Act, the courts have been given the responsibility to define and classify violent and repeat sex offenders as sexual predators. The Jessica Lunsford Act made a provision of mandatory sentencing of 25 years to life in prison for first-time sex offenders and the molesters of children below the age of 12. And the other thing about this is the act also requires lifetime electronic monitoring of sexual predators. But we know that lifetime electronic monitoring doesn't mean anything if the electronic monitoring is not being done properly. So what good does it do to lock somebody up for 25 years in prison and then for the rest of them, their lives have them wear a LoJack if the attention being paid to their compliance is marginal? So we have different states that have laws that are similar to those of the Jessica Lunsford Act that they went ahead and just did on their own. Alabama, Arkansas, Arizona, Georgia, Iowa, Nevada, Oklahoma, Indiana, Oregon, Virginia, and Wisconsin all made their own laws that were pretty similar to the Jessica Lunsford Act. In 2005, Michigan, following the Jessica Act, enacted a new law, for example, that had a provision that violent sex offenders can even be forced to wear GPS electronic devices for life. Following Jessica's law, Iowa mandated life sentences for certain sex crimes against children. Indiana authorized a life sentence for certain repeat sex offenders. And the list goes on and on and on. In Georgia, the mandatory sentencing of 25 years in prison is applicable also for teen sex offenders between the age of 13 and 15 who get tried as adults for forced rape, molestation, and sodomy of children. So Jessica's law has become a major focus across the criminal justice realm for state policymakers to classify sex offenders in different categories according to different types of sex offenses. So there are two kinds of models that we follow in the assessment of the sex offenders now that the legislatures have provided subject matter expert-based definitions that they want to be followed within their particular states. One method is called the clinical method, one is called the clinical model, and one is called the actuarial model. So if you take a look at a risk assessment prediction table, you know, you have prediction at the top, and you have outcome on the left, and you have a true positive prediction or a false negative prediction, or you have a false positive prediction or a true negative prediction. These are your four potential outcomes that you have in the prediction process. You know, maybe you predict that they are going to be an offender and they do end up being a reoffender, and so you have a true positive. Maybe you think that they won't be an offender, they end up becoming an offender, so you have a false negative. Maybe you believe that they won't become an offender and they don't become an offender. Well, then you have a true negative prediction. And maybe you predict they will become an offender and they don't become one and you have a false positive. So we want to make sure that when we're predicting in these four boxed categories of what can happen, we want to try to align our predictions up so that we have a true positive prediction or a true negative prediction. We don't want false positives. And we don't want false negatives. Those are what we're trying to stay away from. So one of the key issues in sex offender risk assessment then is to avoid this underprediction and overprediction of offending that I just described. The consequences of a false negative prediction include a heightened risk of harm to future victims, as potential repeat offenders may not receive the treatment or the surveillance that they need. And when we define treatment, we often define treatment as the level of supervision that they get. So if they don't receive the appropriate level of supervision or surveillance, treatment also meaning counseling, follow-up, sometimes medical, psychotropic, then we have a heightened risk of harm. Conversely, false positive predictions waste our resources. They impact on the civil liberties of the criminals who've been released and result in over-intervention, which is counterproductive. These possibilities make reliance on evidence-based risk assessment methods much more important and much more significant to the entire criminal justice process. And correctional psychologists and counselors and treatment service specialists increasingly are being demanded by correctional authorities and the courts to choose the right methods and to avoid the error of making false negative predictions, which is the worst possible prediction that you could make. During the 1990s, there was a rapid growth of literature on risk assessment in sex offenders. As the number of sex offenses were growing and more sex offenders were being convicted and incarcerated, the public fear of sexual killings and kidnappings was increasing because the media had more sex offenders to talk about in the news. So policymakers increased pressure on correctional authorities to be more accountable for sex offender classification, assessment, custody, and parole decisions, and the directions on treatment services, because the media was ensuring that the public was nervous enough about what was happening with them for them to have to try to quell some of the paranoia in the streets. This all led to the growth of a new movement from the beginning of the 1990s to bring more objectivity and empirical analysis on the development of methods for sex offender risk assessment, which was a very positive development. There began to emerge a new community of scholars who specialized in sex offender risk assessment. And there also emerged some private professional groups of experts, the Sinclair Seminars, Orange Psychological Services, who specialized in providing risk assessment services to correctional institutions based on their experience and their knowledge base. So there's two key issues that are raised and debated in choosing the right methodology for sex offender risk management. The first is whether the methodology is based on static or dynamic factors. The assessment of dangerousness among sex offenders is concerned with those characteristics of the offenders that increase or decrease risk. The core question here is what? What factors or characteristics can predict sex offender recidivism with some high degree of validity? How do we know? The controversy is about the recognition and ID of the core set of factors related to recidivism. Because we have them in prison and we're providing counseling and we've done the punishment phase of things, we're supposed to then in some way utilize treatment to rehab these people so that when they get out, they don't recidivate. So you have static risk factors, which are things like of the offender's gender, their race, their ethnicity, their age, the offense history, their conviction records, their relationship to the victims, deviant sexual preference for children, if they have an antisocial personality disorder or psychopathic behavior, deviant sexual age preferences, dysfunctional socialization, those kinds of things are all static risk factors, right? Dynamic risk factors are those that change over time. They're dynamic. They are open to change both through treatment and interventions. And they may be situational and intangible, such as substance abuse, motivation, isolation, antisocial attitudes, lack of social networks, lack of victim empathy, intimacy deficits, poor self-management, deviant sexual fantasies. These dynamic factors are also often defined as criminogenic needs of the offenders. And we've talked about criminogenic identification in criminals across the board. It doesn't have to do, the term of criminogenic doesn't apply just towards sex offenders. We're taking a term that we apply toward criminals as a whole because we understand that the term is appropriately used. And in this particular case, in this particular seminar, we're applying it specifically against sex offenders. These criminogenic needs include a set of attitudes that appear to support negative attitude toward all forms of authority, or conventional pursuits such as education and work and pro-social relationships. They tend to support deviant attitudes and values that justify being aggressive and being hostile, using substance abuse, using substances, rationalizations for antisocial behavior, being free from moral constraints. These are the criminogenic needs of offenders that support attitudes that are antisocial and self-destructive on the part of the criminal. The second is about the method of analysis of the relationship between and among different static and dynamic factors and their impact on recidivism. And the core question here is, well, how are these factors going to be examined and analyzed so that you can predict something about the recidivism? You know, should we be basing all this stuff on clinical judgments? Should it rely on statistical tools and methods that are more objective? You know, the clinical judgments are going to be highly subjective and very costly. The literature on risk assessment of sex offenders is broadly divided into these two approaches, that clinical model and that actuarial model of analysis. Before 1990s, the clinical model was the dominant form of risk assessment. You had to have the psychiatrist come in, the PhD come in, the certified person come in, and utilize the clinical model to make their sophisticated determination as to the potential for risk and reentry requirements. Risk assessment at that time was done on the basis of the clinical experience of whoever it was that you had come in and the psychoanalytic understanding of the repressive and neurotic behaviors of the offenders. It was a modified approach to what those same practitioners may have had in people who were coming to their offices, but in a more extreme way. So the clinical model was a well-published, well-understood means to reach the behavioral predictions through introspections in the subjective understanding of the psychopathic behaviors of the individual offender. Is that enough big words used in the same sentence? Yeah, you understand where I'm coming from in this, though, right? The clinical model was an individualized kind of assessment that made that determination. But then from the beginning of the 1990s, the risk assessment research community began to move away from the clinical model, and the actuarial approach emerged as a new paradigm for predicting violent behavior in general. And what was happening in the 1990s? Well, not only did we have this huge growth of the corrections industry in this country, but we also had the introduction of computer resources that we hadn't had before in such a portable way that just about everybody could get involved in generating an algorithm and some kind of study and some kind of statistical analysis that before had been very, very difficult to do. So when we take a look at an actuarial risk assessment procedure, what we see is that it involves discerning the variables predictive of recidivism and assigning them relative weights. And these relative weights then create a score, and that score equates to whether the person is a lower, medium, or a high-risk case. In the clinical method, the decision-maker would combine information in their own head. They would figure out, based on their experience, what they thought the situation might be. In the actuarial or statistical method, the human judge is eliminated, and conclusions rest solely on empirically established relations between data and the conditions. So in the clinical model, we go from having that specially trained psychiatrist who psychoanalytically determines the potential of the sex offender to recidivate. And now we've shifted. We've had a 560% increase in our correctional populations. We can't find enough clinical people who want to get involved in this, much less being able to afford them. And so we came up with a cheaper method that we hoped was going to be just as good. The cheaper method, the actuarial method, was based on empirically generated data, and we developed studies that then showed us that they had a high correlation to what really happened. So there are several actuarial sex offender risk methods or scales that are available to us within the risk assessment community. One of them is called PRAISOR, the Rapid Risk Assessment for Sex Offender Recidivism. There's the Static 99, which is the sexual violence risk device. We have SORAG, which is the Sex Offender Risk Appraisal Guide, VRAG, which is the Violence Risk Appraisal Guide, and it goes on and on and on. I'm not going to read all of these to you because they're in your text. Okay, this is a good stopping point. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Don't go away. Hello, everybody. This is Mike Pozesny from American Public Safety Training Institute with a web address of www.tapsti.org. This two-hour session includes the work of Albert Roberts in this textbook entitled Correctional Counseling and Treatment, Evidence-Based Perspective. This is a Prentice Hall text published in 2008 by Pearson. I'm your host during this seminar, and the seminar is dedicated to my students, to the men and women of public safety, and to the juvenile justice counselors and probation officers, administrators, and all the rest of those folks who try to inform us how to be better peacekeepers. But PRASOR is a big one. PRASOR is widely used in the United States and Canada, and it's a four-item actuarial scale designed to measure sex offender recidivism among males who have at least one prior conviction for sex offense. And so right here you can see where some of the actuarial scales have some drawbacks, because you have to use an actual actuarial scale for it to have validity. You have to use an actuarial scale that fits the offender, the sex offender that you're dealing with. The four items that the PRASOR takes a look at are prior sex offenses, any unrelated victims, any male victims, and the age being less than 25. One of the unique features of the PRASOR is that it used data from 7 different follow-up studies that were then cross-validated on a different sample. So not only was the sample size large, but the studies originated from various countries, which added a lot of cultural values into it. So PRASOR showed a moderate level of predictive accuracy across all those samples, with average correlation significantly better than the best single predictor at the time. And that's where PRASOR really rose to prominence. The Static 99 is an actuarial instrument that was created by Hansen and Thornton in 99, which added together the items from the PRASOR and the SACJ, the SACJ Min. The scale is called the Static 99. And that indicates that it includes only static factors. That's why static comes from. And the current version is this year's version of the work in progress, which this year at that time was 99. So Static 99, because it uses static factors and it was devised in 99. The Static 99 was designed to estimate the probability of sexual and violent recidivism among adult males who have already been convicted of at least one sexual offense, and this time it's specifically against a child or a non-consenting adult. So think back in your power and control thing, and that's part of the equation of this thing. The scale has 10 static items: prior sexual offenses, prior sentencing dates, any convictions for non-contact sex offenses, current convictions for non-sexual violence, prior convictions for non-sexual violence, unrelated victims, stranger victims, male victims, young and single. When the Static 99 scale is tested across 4 diverse samples, the resulting scale predicted sexual offense recidivism better than either of the 2 scales that it was made up of. So that worked out real, real well. So there's some consensus among risk assessment researchers that the actuarial methods, the second generation risk assessment methods, are much more able to produce high validity predictions about recidivism than the first generation methods of the clinical model. And that's why something like the Static 99 end up working out real well, because they're taking these first generation and combining them and then working their way through the sex offender assessment process using those. Another group within the risk assessment community claims that there should be a bridge of thought between those two types of models, the actuarial and the clinical. They're saying that the actuarial models are based primarily on the analysis of static factors, where the clinical model can take into account the dynamic factors, and then what we need to do is to put it all together. And that's not a good idea. The actuarial methods are designed to make absolute prediction of a specified behavior within a specified time period and tend not to measure those dynamic changes that are essentially subjective, folks. That, you know, you need to have a clinical assessment capable person take into consideration. Even the meta-analysis studies that we've used have focused on static factors. So it's critical that we get more research done and possibly generate some better assessment devices over time. There is a third generation of sex offender risk assessment methods that have come out, and they're called SPJs. Now, this third generation structured professional judgment, or SPJs, combine the first generation methods of clinical judgment with the second generation actuarial assessments. And some of the third generation sex offender risk assessment methods include SONAR, which is an acronym for the Sex Offender Need Assessment Rating, the SAVRI, the Structured Assessment for Violence Risk Among Youth, SARA, the Spousal Abuse Risk Assessment, and the list goes on and on and on. The general consensus within correctional practitioners and risk assessment researchers today is that SPJs are more reliable for sex offender risk assessment. They're an updated version of things that we have been using for a good amount of time. And considering the dynamic factors such as treatment effects and motivation and sexual deviance and general psychological programs alongside the actuarial risk classification stuff, that these SPJs may provide more global and valid assessment of the offender's risk for sexual recidivism. So what you have to do within your local environment is to find out what model it is that you're supposed to use, and then use the most current thing that you can afford and that you have the training to be able to utilize. The thing is the second generation actuarial assessment methods have generated a lot of empirical studies, and they've made wonderful contributions in the understanding of the complexity of sex offending, sex offender recidivism, and those kinds of things. They have established sex offender risk assessment as a separate field of scientific research and as a professional specialty. But the problem with advocates that only want to use actuarial assessment by itself is that they have defined the concept of recidivism from that very narrow actuarial perspective. They fail to take into account the more qualitative nature of assessment and make a distinction between the dangerousness of that individual and their recidivist behavior. The recidivist behavior is a complex amalgam, if you were, of attitudes and life situations, and it's broader than the concept of just labeling somebody as being violent or dangerous. There's also the thought that they have failed to see sex offender assessment in the context of correctional management and a comprehensive approach to sex offender management. By relying basically on static factors, they ignored the social and psychological pathways that were related to the development of deviant sexual behavior. It's basically that they took a look at the person after they had finished their development into utilizing sexual behavior and then failed to understand the core of the deviance and where it originated. Secondly, these actuarial assessment advocates have also ignored the legal and human implications of their probabilistic assessments. If a sex offender, for example, is defined as a sexual predator in most states today, they could stay in prison for the rest of their lives, or they could be in civil commitment or registered for life. On the other hand, if a violent sex offender is released into the community, public security will be threatened and compromised, and risk assessment of sex offenders in correctional settings is also of high importance. There are legal and ethical considerations that have to be considered when you are responsible for the people that you have incarcerated and for their safety and welfare. So risk assessment of sex offenders has to be approached and understood from a multidimensional perspective, both nomothetic and ideological ideographic approaches need to be combined for developing assessment methods and making assessment decisions. And these third generation assessment methods that we were talking about seem to be moving in the right direction. So what is the third issue with actuarial assessments alone model? In post-positivist science, which is something that my research class really focuses on, there's nothing called certainty in scientific research, right? In post-positivist science, the notion of observable facts as undeniable givens, wholly dependent, independent of our fragile and insecure interpretations of them, was all but surrendered. And the idea that there was anything given in an experience was thrown into jeopardy. That's by Shapir of 1985. And so one of the critical notions in science today and in measuring these assessment tools is the idea of uncertainty. And we have to understand that there is nothing which is certain. And the utilizing the prediction of recidivism within sex offenders at the high regard in which we place it, with an expectation level which is higher than what the systems can actually generate, dooms us to fail, dooms us to making the wrong decisions, and places an expectation level upon us where all we'll be able to do is to fail. So given the enormous complexity of human sexuality, sex offender risk assessment methods and decisions are more vulnerable to uncertainties than just about anything else that we could try to do. And as a result of that, they have to be based on knowledge and experience from different professional groups, different communities, and be multidimensional in how it is that they actually measure things. So in most correctional settings, the actuarial assessment approach is applied in combination with clinical or other approaches. Sex offender risk assessment in most states is a legislative mandate. And in many states, there are specialized boards that take care of all that. And we named some of those boards a little while ago. In 2001, the Virginia Criminal Sentencing Commission published a report based on prior research and through an independent study that was conducted by them. And the commission tracked 579 felony sex offenders released from prison between 90 and 93, on average for about 8 years. The study defined recidivism specifically to mean a new arrest for a sex offense or against person offense. Three independent analyses of the data were done by applying three different statistical techniques: logistic regression, survival analysis, and classification tree analysis. On the basis of these three independent analyses, two models emerged that were able to inform us as to the significance of a similar set of static and dynamic factors for recidivism. These static and dynamic factors came down to nine things: offender age, offender education, employment, relationship with the victim, aggravated sexual battery, the location of the offenses, criminal history that the abuser had, prior incarceration, and prior treatment. Ohio did the same thing in 2006. They generated a study to try to determine what the case was going, and determined that the static 99 was the best thing that they could use. The Vermont assessment of sex offender risk is something that was developed. It was based on a couple of different scales, using a 13-item reoffense scale and a 6-item violence scale. And so it began to be being used. The Colorado Sex Offender Management Board had legislative mandates to work on the development of actuarial assessment tools and management strategies, and they had developed their own tools. So what we're finding is that some states are using statistical prediction tools that are applicable within their own states and fit within the culture, the correctional culture that they have at their locations. In 2006, the Washington State Institute for Public Policy conducted an evaluation under a mandate from their state legislature and on their sexual offender classification tool. And on the basis of that study of 684 sex offenders that were released from Washington state prisons in the 2 years between 97 and 99, The study found that within 5 years, 22% would have recidivated with a felony offense, 3% with a felony sex offense. Recidivism rates, they found, do not consistently increase when the assessment scores a 25-point increase. So they, in using these assessment tools, were not able to sufficiently predict trend of recidivism within sex offenders. Okay, this is a good stopping point. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Don't go away. Everybody, this is Mike Pozesny from American Public Safety Training Institute with a web address of www.tapsti.org. This two-hour session includes the work of Albert Roberts in this textbook entitled Correctional Counseling and Treatment, Evidence-Based Perspective. This is a Prentice Hall text published in 2008 by Pearson. I'm your host during this seminar, and the seminar is dedicated to my students, to the men and women of public safety, and to the juvenile justice counselors and probation officers, administrators, and all the rest of those folks who try to inform us how to be better peacekeepers. So for correctional institutions to search for and rely on some balanced, comprehensive, and evidence-based assessment measure is significant. It's not just for the improvement of sex offender management and the treatment of sex offenders. It has legal implications as well as additional people become victims in the states of this country. And as more of those states are reacting by setting up their own sexual predator laws and laws for civil commitment of sexually violent predators, the methods and the tools of sex offender classification are being increasingly challenged by the courts. And the courts get into the fry test, that looks at expert opinion being based on scientific technique and being admissible if it is generally accepted as a reliable technique in the scientific community as what they base a lot of this stuff on. You have the Daubert rule, Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, where it's not the experts but the trial judges who need to be the gatekeepers of science in the court. Daubert brought about a fundamental change in the way that some of our courts were doing because it confirmed that there was a post-positivist notion of uncertainty in scientific evidence. And it is this need for common consensus that demands a bridge of thought between the actuarial and the clinical approaches to sex offender risk assessment. Federal law clearly suggests that assessment of SVP classification must be made by a court after considering the recommendation of a board, which is composed of experts in the treatment and behavior of sex offenders, victims' rights advocates, representatives of law enforcement agencies, and the entire public safety community as a whole. So there's various court cases that can explain what we're doing with sex offenders, but we need to take a look at the statutes now that we're applying against these offenders in being able to try to manage this population. Formal psychiatric treatment for incarcerated sex offenders has long been a policy to combat sex offender recidivism, right? The advocates of the progressive movement in the beginning of the 20th century in the 1900s thought that sexual offending was a sickness and it could be treated through the application of biology or psychology. And in the 40s and 50s, a lot of states enacted psychopathic laws. And psychopathic laws defined sexual offenders as people who have psychopathic personalities, a concept that's currently defined by psychiatry as antisocial personality disorder. The enactment of psychopathic statutes in the 50s by different states came in the context of the public fearing child molesters and the growth for the medicalization of deviants. And we have to remember that it was in the 60s, as this was really starting to take hold, that the medicalization of deviants was being impacted by the shutting down of our large mental health facilities across this country in favor of trying to get mental health drilled down to the local communities that the mental health people suffering from mental illness came from, because we believed that they would be more effectively treated in the local communities. Well, between the 60s and the 90s, that really didn't help. From the late 90s, treatment began to be seen as a viable option for dealing with sex offenders, but that was after we had already started creating laws based on a reactionary climate on those that had been released from the major mental health hospitals. And this is what created, in the late 1990s, this is what created CSOM, the Center for Sex Offender Management, who performed research and came up with suggestions on sex offender treatment and sex offender rehabilitation and those kinds of things. So 34 states had formal psychiatric treatment methods available for sex offenders as of 2000, roughly 15 years ago. There are 8 states: Alabama, California, Delaware, Florida, Mississippi, New Mexico, Oregon, and D.C., that didn't have any formal treatment options for incarcerated sex offenders. In some states, as in Minnesota, incarceration times are extended for failure to participate in your treatment programs, but that's still better than states that don't have any formal treatment programs at all. A number of sex offender programs are available for prisons. These methods suggest 4 approaches to treatment, inclusive of psychological, pharmacological, biological, and sociological. In practice, these approaches are not mutually exclusive, and treatment programs are utilizing a combination of those techniques. It just depends on how they're delivered to people. 20 states, about 50% of the programs, offer more intensive forms of this multidimensional approach. Usually involves some cognitive behavioral intervention aspect to it. Treatment of sex offenders in what we call therapeutic communities is based on a psychoeducational approach aimed at reducing the risk of recidivism through the use of effective self-management. So we use psychoeducational approaches all the time in what? Alcohol and drug counseling, anger management counseling. You know, the emphasis is on the need for the offenders to take responsibility for their actions, recognize the behavioral progression that proceeded and followed the offenses that they created, identify situations that place them at risk to reoffend, and assist them in developing strategies to prevent recidivism. So core focus areas of this kind of treatment are defining and taking responsibility, victim empathy, social skills, sex education, anger management, arousal reconditioning, victim empathy, overcoming past trauma, and relapse prevention. And the general duration of the treatment in 28 states is over a year. So whatever it is that they do, you can't sentence them on a misdemeanor, because you'll lose them after a year unless you're able to multi-case it. North Dakota, Arizona, and Massachusetts provide treatments over 5 years. The cognitive behavioral therapy and psychoeducational therapeutic community approaches are primarily based on the theories and concepts inclusive of psychology, psychiatry, sociology, social work, and whatever the other human sciences that they might borrow some information from. Okay, this is a good stopping point. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. This is Mike Pozesny from American Public Safety Training Institute with a web address of www.tapsti.org. This two-hour session includes the work of Albert Roberts in this textbook entitled Correctional Counseling and Treatment, Evidence-Based Perspective. This is a Prentice Hall text published in 2008 by Pearson. I'm your host during this seminar, and the seminar is dedicated to my students, to the men and women of public safety, and to the juvenile justice counselors and probation officers, administrators, and all the rest of those folks who try to inform us how to be better peacekeepers. Now, some states have decided to follow alternatives to cognitive behavioral therapy and therapeutic community approaches, and have decided to approach treatment of sexual predators from a pharmacological approach. And they have actually enacted laws for sex offender castration. In 1996, California became the first state to legalize chemical castration. In 97, a mandatory chemical castration law was passed in Florida. As of 2006, 9 states, California, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Montana, Oregon, Texas, Virginia, and Wisconsin, have enacted laws for chemical castration. Options for surgical castration, which is removal of the testes, not the phallus, are available in California, Florida, and Texas. The Florida statute mandates that repeat sex offenders are given court-ordered weekly injections of hormones and anti-androgens drugs such as Depo-Provera and Depo-Lupron that reduce sex drives. Under the Florida statute, chemical castration can be part of sentencing given to sex offenders. Mandatory court-ordered chemical castration is also used as part of the castration law in Montana. In Montana, a judge can legally require a repeat violent sex offender to undergo chemical castration. In Texas, both chemical and surgical castrations are voluntary, and surgical sex offenders are not considered for castrations. The Texas statute describes that castrations are legally allowed when the offender is a repeat child molester, and it's recommended through psychiatric evaluations and a combination of offender treatments, and it probably is very effective when we decide that that person is not going to accomplish not relapsing once they get released back out into the general public. Okay, this is a good stopping point. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Don't go away. Hello, everybody. This is Mike Pozesny from American Public Safety Training Institute with a web address of www.tapsti.org. This two-hour session includes the work of Albert Roberts in this textbook entitled Correctional Counseling and Treatment, Evidence-Based Perspective. This is a Prentice Hall text published in 2008 by Pearson. I'm your host during this seminar, and the seminar is dedicated to my students, to the men and women of public safety, and to the juvenile justice counselors and probation officers, administrators, and all the rest of those folks who try to inform us how to be better peacekeepers. So sex offender treatment and recidivism. The field of empirical studies on relations between treatment and sex offender recidivism is still pretty young. Because why? We have only had a lot of the laws on the books within the last 10 or 15 years. And then you have to train researchers and they have to get the experience that's necessary. And then they have to get grants, which means grants have to be established. We're just now beginning to have the processes available to us to be able to do the research that needs to be done. As interests are growing on expanding sex offender treatments and corrections in the context of a comprehensive approach, studies are beginning to grow on understanding the relations between different aspects of this, treatment versus recidivism and those kinds of things. A lot of empirical studies are starting to be done based on by criminal justice agencies based in within different states. So you have the Alaska Department of Corrections, Colorado, and Iowa all conducting their own studies of all these things. And a lot of empirical studies have shown that pharmacological interventions are successful in reducing sex offender recidivism. Bradford and Kay in 2006 wrote that there is empirical evidence that CPA and sertraline have a differential effect on the sexual arousal pattern of pedophiles, suppressing the pedophilic arousal and enhancing the arousal toward adult consensual sexual activity. Studer, Alwyn, and Redden in 2005 studied the effect of testosterone treatment on sex offender recidivism, and they found that serum testosterone remains significantly predictive of sexual recidivism for the treatment non-completer group. So cognitive behavioral approaches have been found to have positive effects on reducing recidivism, but it's also been found that cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is more effective if it's combined with other approaches. If you take CBT, psychoeducational, and sociological approaches and put them together, then you've got a pretty effective treatment system. McGrath, Cumming, Livingston, and Hoke in 2003 conducted a study of the rate recidivism of 195 adult sex offenders that were drawn from the Vermont DOC, computerized offender records, who were referred to receive prison-based CBT. Out of 195 referred sex offenders, 56 completed treatments. 49 received some treatments but didn't complete the whole thing, and 90 just flat out refused to participate. When they followed up in 6 years, the number of sexual offenders in the completed treatment group, which was 5.4%, was significantly lower than that of the some treatment group at 30% and the no treatment group at 30%. So check it out. At least if they got some treatment, it reduced them to about 30%. If they got no treatment, it was still at 30%. If they completed the treatment, it dropped all the way to 5%. So what's the lesson here, boys and girls? The lesson is to get them into the treatment and then enforce the completion of that treatment to drop them from 30% to roughly 5%. Positive results of sex offender treatments have also been found by a lot of empirical studies done by state criminal justice agencies, such as the Ohio State Department of Corrections, reporting that offenders who successfully completed their sex offender treatment program have a lower arrest rate for sex offenders than other offenders that didn't. Colorado found the same thing. The Alaska Department of Corrections conducted a treatment evaluation study in collaboration with the Justice Center of the University of Alaska in Anchorage, and the study there came up with some very important observations, 4 main observations that were very important. One is that a treatment effect was clearly demonstrated. Number 2, treatment improved survival in the community without a reoffense. Their mindfulness was improved. Number 3, rapists and child sexual abusers are equally positively affected by treatment programs, which means there's some hope. And number 4, Alaska's native offenders do not progress as well in the program as non-native offenders do. The overall estimation is that sex offender treatment reduces sexual recidivism by about 10%. The generally accepted recidivism rate is about 30% for all untreated sex offenders and about 20% for treated sex offenders. And this is from CSOM in 2003. So let's take a look and conclude this presentation on sex offenders. The sex offender risk assessment and treatment that we do today are not isolated policy instruments or scientific constructs. They're an integral part of a comprehensive sex offender management model. We have a lot of people involved in it, and a lot of we've moved from the clinical method to the actuarial method, and part of the reason for that is that we need to involve individuals who don't have the academic or the experiential training necessarily that the clinicians would have, but still need to have an integrated and accurate assessment tool. So we've provided those tools now based on the empirical evidence that the research that we have done on these inmates has provided. The incarceration, the registration, the community notification, the civil commitment, the reentry management, all these things largely depend on the risk assessment and treatment success. If we don't assess them properly on the front end and we don't get them into the proper treatment, then all the rest of these things are going to be for naught. Okay, this is a good stopping point. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Don't go away. Hello, everybody. This is Mike Pozesny from American Public Safety Training Institute with a web address of www.tapsti.org. This two-hour session includes the work of Albert Roberts in this textbook entitled Correctional Counseling and Treatment, Evidence-Based Perspective. This is a Prentice Hall text published in 2008 by Pearson. I'm your host during this seminar, and the seminar is dedicated to my students, to the men and women of public safety, and to the juvenile justice counselors and probation officers, administrators, and all the rest of those folks who try to inform us how to be better peacekeepers. The sexual offender risk assessment methods are in their third evolutionary step. The first generation assessment methods from the 70s and 80s were clinical in their orientations. The second generation assessment methods, the actuarial assessment methods, emerged during the 80s and the 90s. From that time, risk assessment grew as a specialization in scientific research, particularly in psychology or in social work and counseling and all those human sciences. Borrowing methodological tools from mathematics and statistics, the advocates of this new movement of actuarial assessment created a new paradigm and a new community to follow that. The new advocates of the movement firmly belied the risks that can be scientifically and objectively measured with a high degree of certainty, and these measurements should not be contaminated with subjective thoughts like you get from clinical judgment. You know, so the success that we have had in the actuarial assessment methods, they felt, as of the 1980s and 1990s, shouldn't be compromised. But starting in the late 1990s, the paradigm of actuarial assessment began to be questioned because we weren't having as much success as we wanted to have. So the SPJ movement grew, the structured professional judgment grew. And this third generation methods, which combined the static with the dynamic factors and the actuarial assessments with the clinical judgments, puts everything together and provides us with a broader overview of the individual inmate and the potential for risk that they present to the system. So like sex offender risk assessment approaches, sex offender treatment methods have also gone through a process of change and evolution. Back in the 40s and the 50s, sex offenders were generally seen as psychopathic personalities, and a lot of states enacted psychopathic laws. Treatments based on Freudian psychoanalysis were generally prescribed for sex offenders. Why? Because we had a clinician approach to the assessment. So it made sense that using a clinician approach to the assessment would lead to a clinical psychoanalytical approach to the treatment, right? So from the 1970s and 1980s, we grew in our knowledge of biology and neurology and brain research and psychiatry and all these behavioral sciences. And out of all this growth came a new notion that sexual behavior and sex offending are multidimensional. And as a result of that, sex offender treatments have to also be multidimensional because of all the different facets. So now, as a result of all of this research and all this trial and error stuff, there's four basic approaches to sex offender treatments: psychological, pharmacological, biological, and sociological. All 50 states employ some combination of psychological, pharmacological, biological, and sociological approaches. A considerable amount of empirical literature has been done and has examined the relationships between sex offender treatment and the recidivism when they get back out on the street. And in spite of all of that, we're still looking at a 30% recidivism factor overall. We see that treatment helps to reduce recidivism by about 10%. So we're expending our energies and just trying to realize that 10% improvement. Effective risk assessment tools and treatment methods are critically important for meeting the correctional challenges we have in the 21st century for managing sex offenders and the containment of sex crimes. The development of effective assessments and treatments has to be based on evidence-based research, and we need to march on that. We need to have more evidence-based policies and practices and correctional innovations. And we need to continue to marry the two communities of research and practice, and we need to integrate the issues of law, justice, ethics, and morality into all of our sex offender risk assessment and treatment in order to be able to provide for safer communities. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to the American Public Safety Training Institute, America's best source for online public safety training. We hope you enjoy today's training presentation with your host, Mike Pozesny.